Accession number 30862, Reel 1.
It's interesting, there's no way to... cleverly designed, so...
Ladies and gentlemen, if I could have your attention for a few minutes. Thank you very much. First of all, welcome to the Imperial War Museum. My name is Max Archer. I'm an historian. And this is the fourth gathering of Forgotten Voices, because I did the first two. And Lynn Smith, who I believe is in the room as well. Where are you, Lynn? Oh, good. Well done. Well done. Was number three. A marvellous book on Forgotten Voices of the Holocaust. And we have today a truly remarkable book written by a very remarkable man. This is Forgotten Voices of the Blitz and the Battle for Britain. It's a superb book. You've got to buy it. You've got to read it. It will change your view, I think, in many ways, on the Battle of Britain, and certainly on the pain and the pressure that this country went through during the Blitz. It's captured, I think, like no one else has captured the Blitz, really got to the heart and the hell of the Blitz remarkably well. I love the sound of the children. Josh, had he continued in his previous lives, would certainly have been a very eminent barrister, and certainly had he, and I do hope that he will continue with his playwriting, because I think in a few years' time Tom Stoppard is really going to have to look to his laurels. And he's really is a sort of man who's a Renaissance man, capable of writing in many, many fields with an alarming accuracy and perspicacity as well. He's also a first-rate actor, so he's unending, really. My great and only fear is that he will ever take up and become a financial advisor. Those of you who know and love him, you will understand that. It takes your father to put you in your place. Josh, you've written an immensely good book. Congratulations, and I look forward to hearing from what you've got to say now on the journey you've made through this enormous book.
Thank you. Well, thank you all very much for coming. The people that I really want to thank most of all are the men and women who are here today who were there. We've got, we're exceptionally lucky to have three pilots who flew in the Battle of Britain. We have Bam Bamberger, we have Graham Leggett, we have Basil Stapleton. This actually is Basil Stapleton's book, which is here, and I'm sure he'd be happy to talk to you about it later. But the honour of having these people here in 2006, when what we're talking about took place in the summer of 1940, it is just an exceptional honour. We also have Dame Joan Varley, who was a young woman during the Blitz and will be speaking to us about that. She has some very moving stories. She was also a member of the Women's Auxiliary Air Force. We have Stan Poole, who is a member of the Home Guard and a member of the Auxiliary Fire Service. And what I want you to remember when you're listening to these people and hopefully sharing a drink with them afterwards is that these people actually represent the spirit of a different period, a very different period. It's a period which is still within living memory, just when the British people actually feared for their independence and their liberty. You've actually got to remember that. This is not, you know, we live in our slightly cosseted time now. And occasionally we're shaken out of it by some sort of world event or a bombing or something that happens. But this was a period when the people of this country actually genuinely believed that they were about to be invaded. Victory was by no means assured. Invasion seemed very, very likely. But at the same time as you had this going on, you had an extraordinary sort of sea change going on in the social perspective of the country. You had evacuation. My father, who's already made one observation this afternoon, was an evacuee himself. He was evacuated out to Biggleswade as a very young boy. He features in the book. There was rationing, there was blackout, there was an ever-present sense of danger throughout the Blitz. And how could that do anything but actually to transform social lives on a daily basis? So you're talking about a period when people were brought together by circumstances. You had people eating the same food, people wearing the same clothes, buying the same furniture. They were taking shelter together, fire watching together. You had poor children being evacuated into the homes of wealthier people. So what you had was a new Britain, which was actually being forged. You had a Britain which gave rise to the Beveridge Report, to the welfare state, possibly to the Labour government in 1945, certainly to a world of greater expectations, and ultimately to the world we live in today. So this is a period when the seeds of modern Britain were being planted. I mean, you can often hear people talking about the 1960s as this period of decadence when, you know, all of modern ills, the breakdown of morality was... Well, perhaps we can look a bit further and say that if there really is anything very wrong with modern Britain, which is debatable, perhaps this was the period where it all started. Now, this book is... very important, he said modestly, from one point of view. It's quite possibly the last chance to hear the views of the actual people involved. The participants for whom these events are not simply dry statistical detail, but an actual living reality, living memory. Because what's going to happen is in the future, historians are going to take these events, they're going to take the Battle of Britain, they're going to take the Blitz, and they're going to mold them into their own theses. They're going to decide, this is what I want to make of it, and this is my evidence. And what these people do in this book, and it's nothing to do with me, it's to do with the fact that these voices are so distinct and so clear. These people take these events, and they vary in their opinions. They disagree in what they say. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they complement each other. They add to what each other says. In fact, most of the time they do. But there certainly are occasions where you'll hear somebody saying something and somebody else disagreeing, or somebody else modifying. And that, after all, is what real life is about. Life, we all know, we all live, we're all alive. Life doesn't happen in black and white. It happens in shades of grey that takes place in between the certainties. And that is why this book is real life placed in front of you, and that is why this book really is important. So I would urge you to appreciate what these people have to say, because they were there. Now finally, I've tried to break away in some degree from previous oral histories to make this actually a running narrative of the period. So in other words, you can start at the beginning and finish at the end, and not just read it in the bath or put it by the toilet. To help with this task, I've had really quite astonishing help from the sound archive at the Imperial War Museum. These people live for what they do, and there's no point even putting it into words. They, for 9 months, 10 months, they have given me access to all their material, all the help they possibly could. So I'd just like to pay tribute to Margaret Brooks, Peter Hart, Richard Madonna, John Stopford Pickering, Richard Hughes, and Rob White. They have absolutely made this thing possible. And then, you know, there's so many other people to thank, so I'm not particularly going to bother. you know who you are. I'd like to thank Max. Max, really, it's true to say, you know, without Max, I clearly wouldn't be doing this book. And we went together to the 60th anniversary party, Battle of Britain celebration at RAF Northolt, and that's when the book actually took some shape that night. My family are here, my parents, and both of them actually did quite a lot of work on the book. Apart from that, thank you all very much for coming. I hope you have a good time. Also, I rather overcompensated with the hospitality. I, in the belief that there were going to be 400 or 500 people coming, I have actually booked the Thai restaurant next door for nibbles and wine afterwards. So I urge you all to come, because there's a lot of Thai food to get to. And also the slight irony, I don't know if this hits anyone else, the slight irony of inviting a lot of World War II veterans to a Thai restaurant also slightly hit me. But as long as everybody's all right with that, let's go there later. And without any further ado, I would like to present, first of all, Bam Bam Burger. This man flew in the Battle of Britain and therefore needs no further introduction. Thank you.
Well, I've got a bit of paper here, just with a few headings of things. Because I didn't know really what I was coming to. No one told me, not even Joshua, not even the publishers. But now Joshua said it all, so it's difficult to know where to start. First of all, you know, forgotten voices. I thought that may have been wrong. Then I thought of voices from the past would be better. Then I thought, well, past is associated with the dead, so probably I better stick with forgotten voices. And why we hear the voices that are here today, I think possibly the Almighty thought he'd keep a few of them alive. So of the voices that are in the book, who are no longer with us, we can sort of sing their praises. My contribution was through the good offices of the Imperial War Museum, was to sit and chat at home while, I've forgotten your name, taped it, and I just chatted away. There was no formulated sentences or anything like that. Your mind just drifted. And in the end, it ended up with 12 CDs. But I thought these were going to the Imperial War Museum, be buried 50 feet deep, and in 50 years' time, they'd be dug up. They wouldn't have a machine to translate them, and so they'd be thrown away. So when I suddenly find it in print, it was a bit of a shock. Though there's been many books written about the Blitz and the Battle of Britain, you know, the censuses were formulated, the documentary producers, you know, directed you where they wanted to go. And as I glance to Forgotten Voices, probably what comes out of it more than anything else is truth. And so that is the reason I would commend it to you. Now, I'm here as a sergeant pilot in the Bratton Britain flying Spitfires, and so possibly you expect me to say something about that. So now I'll just try and give you an impression of one flight in one day, because sometimes you flew, say, three or four times a day, and from books and documentaries you hear all this noise and machine guns chattering. It wasn't like that at all, generally speaking. There were few rare occasions, but you went up, you didn't know what was going to happen. Waiting to go up was the worst part of it. Not when you were up there. When you were up there, you knew you had to do something, hey, for the sake of ceremony, but also to survive. And so I'll just give you a story of just one flight. I was up there, and we'd run into some 109s, and there was lots of metal flying around. I suddenly found there was tracer passing my aircraft, and there was holes appearing in it. And so I went into a very steep turn to get away from it. Now then, ME-109s, who the Spitfires were supposed to look after, had cannons. So there was every chance, more than 50-50 chance, that those bullets were from another Spitfire. Because when you were up there, it was a few seconds of shambles. It wasn't as described frequently in books. And I found myself going down in a spin. So I thought I'd have to bail out. So I undid my straps and was thrown about in the aircraft. Then it took a time to... I remember, I'd never spun a Spitfire before. And had time to train on such things like that. So I thought, oh, I may be in a spin. So I went for what I'd been taught on old biplanes, and I came out of the spin. Gosh, I was proud of myself. I was a bit bruised being thrown about in the aircraft. So I fastened on my straps, and I said, Bamberger, you're brilliant. started to, at that time, my base was Hornchurch, fly back to my base at Hornchurch. And I was so proud of myself, I forgot about the London balloon barrage, and the first thing I knew there was these balloons, so to try and avoid them, which fortunately I did. But of course, it shook my confidence again. No, no, ma'am, you just got to get back home and get down on the ground safely. And which I did. But as I landed at Hornchurch, there was a twanging noise, and both my ailerons, if you know what they are, they're on your wings, which control you, they both dropped down. So my aircraft had been damaged. But if they dropped down at any time in that flight, I'd probably gone straight into the ground. I taxied my aircraft in and parked it. And my ground crew appeared, and so did the sergeant in charge of the flight line. And all he said to me, another bloody aircraft's unserviceable. So that was the greeting when you've flown in the Battle of Britain. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much to BAM. We now have Dame Joan Varley.
Well, I feel very privileged to be here this morning and to be at the launch of Joshua's fascinating book, which has awoken so many half-forgotten memories. Now, he's asked me to give a description of some of my adventures during the bombing of London. I was living in London in Streatham with my parents. We lived in a maisonette, the upper maisonette of a terraced house in Streatham. Now, Streatham was quite heavily bombed during the war because of the adjacent railway line which ran from Brighton up to London. And even though we had a strict blackout, railway lines can be seen from the air in surprisingly dark nights. And the air bombers would fly up, and we always thought that on their way back from London, any spare bombs they got, they unloaded on us. I was 20, actually, when the Blitz started, and I very well remember the first night of the real Blitz. We'd had sirens, and we'd had the odd bombs dropped, but nowhere near us. And we were going slowly down to the cellar at the bottom of the house after the siren, when suddenly a stick of three bombs came down, the first that we'd really heard. And I can remember some frightened faces as we fell down the steps into the cellar, absolutely terrified. One of the bombs landed in the middle of our road, just not opposite our house, fortunately, higher up the road. And then, as is described by somebody in Joshua's book, after any incident, there was always what seemed like minutes, but was probably only seconds, a total, utter silence. And then a most unearthly wail, absolutely terrifying, went up into the air. And it was all the dogs, pet dogs and cats, in the houses round. It was the first time, of course, they'd heard a bomb, the first time we had, really. And they never did it again, which was rather curious. Well, now, I had a job in a bank in Shaftesbury Avenue, so I used to travel up in the morning, and by that time the Blitz was usually over, and I would see the damage that had been caused during the night. Then after the bank, I would walk to Aldwych, where I was studying with night classes for a degree, and the lectures would finish probably about 9, and I would then, at 9 o'clock at night, travel back to Streatham on a bus. And of course the Blitz was really and truly going by that time. And I, at one of these occasions, I had probably one of the strangest incidents I've known in my life. I was travelling on the top deck of the bus, and I was sitting right in the back seat because I was wanting, after my long day, to smoke a cigarette. And in those days it wasn't really considered the done thing for women to smoke in public. So I sat at the back hoping that people wouldn't notice that I was having a cigarette. Well, there was only one other passenger on the top deck, and he was sitting right in the front, literally in the front. And as we approached Westminster down, I think it was probably Great Smith Street, suddenly, of course Blitz was going, suddenly we heard a stick of, they usually drop them in sticks of threes at any rate at the beginning. We heard three bombs come down, and it was plain. By this time one knew, you could tell from the sound of the bomb coming down whether it was near, whether it was very near, whether it was near or whether it was, didn't have to worry. But this was very near, and the bus driver immediately took a turn to the right off the route to avoid this. And the man at the front looked round, and he came down, and he sat next to me, and we held hands as the bus driver skirted round while the bombs went off to our left. We, of course, were sheltered by the tall buildings, but nevertheless, it was pretty frightening. And so we sat there holding hands, and then once we'd passed the explosions, the bus driver came back onto the route, and he then walked back to the front of the bus What was so strange was that neither of us said a word. We never spoke. Again, of course, it wasn't the done thing for young ladies. I was a young lady in those days. It wasn't the done thing to speak to men on buses. But in any case, we didn't. And quite interestingly now, you probably know that if in a road accident, or indeed if you're on a trolley going to the theatre for an operation in the hospital, one of the medics will usually hold your hand. So that obviously holding hands does, in a trauma, has a therapeutic effect. However, I think my nearest, like all Londoners, of course, I've got plenty of stories of near misses. The nearest miss I had was back at home. We'd started by in the cellar, but the family that lived in the maisonette below us was quite large and the cellar was very small. So we moved into an unused Anderson shelter in the garden next door. It happened to be empty at the time. But that only lasted 5 days because we realised that if the bombs didn't get us, we would probably die of pneumonia. Very cold, damp, wet. And so we simply slept upstairs. We covered our windows with brown sticky tape because, of course, the danger for the blast, if the windows came in, you could get badly injured by the flying glass. And we just slept through it. Well, now, one night I was woken by, again, a stick of three bombs coming down. And the first one, I said to myself straight away, this is going to be a direct hit. I knew that it was going to be very, very near. Although it seemed to take ages falling, I did manage to say the Lord's Prayer. And then, when I finished that, I heard it splinter glass as it went through the conservatory at the back of the house next door. We were terraced. And then I waited for the explosion. There was a very loud, dull thud, but nothing happened. Now, this may sound odd. It does to me as I'm saying it. I just went off to sleep again. But we were all very tired in those days. We were, because we really did have disturbed nights. So at breakfast next day, I said to my parents, we've got an unexploded bomb in the conservatory next door. They hadn't heard anything. They hadn't woken, you see. Nobody else in the house had either. So anyway, they just simply didn't believe me. So I went to work with... And I then thought, well, goodness, I ought to be a responsible citizen. So I knocked on the door of the next house, and a very old man came to the door with a sort of shawl round his shoulders, and I said, excuse me, but you've got an unexploded bomb in your conservatory. And he looked at me in fury, and he said, we've nothing like that in this house. And he slammed the door in my face. So I was, well, you know, a crazy world. And anyway, I went off to work. When I got back late at night, there was a barricade round and red ribbons or equivalents of that, and a notice saying, unexploded. And I've always wondered all my life why we weren't evacuated or anything. I don't know, probably they had been at a time in the daytime when I was in the office. But I've always wondered why. But now one of the reading in Joshua's book about the bomb displays of people, of course what had happened was that in the daytime they'd come and they'd taken the fuse out of the bomb, and so it was no longer dangerous, and then they waited a couple of days before they came and dug it out and took it away. Well, now, those are my two, plenty of other stories, but I won't bore you with them. After I got my degree, which would be in, I think, 42, I joined the Air Force, which is what I'd always wanted to do. But I had thought if I broke off studying for the degree, it was such heavy work, I could never go back to it. So I finished, got my degree, and then I joined the Air Force. Now, here I was extremely fortunate, because when you joined, I think they did ask you what you'd like to do, but we all knew that was meaningless. I mean, it would mean a thing. And I was, first of all, trained as a clerk SD, and you see people like myself sometimes in those wartime films pushing little flags round. But then I was remustered in what I think for a woman, or indeed for anybody on the ground, was probably one of the most exciting jobs that you could do in the war, because I went into ground control interception. And here in a small hut, this was radar, in a small hut, we were a team of about five people. And what happened was that when there was the bombers were coming over, Exeter, which was our fighter aerodrome, scrambled the fighters. When they got to the required height, they were handed over to us, and we picked them up on a rather primitive PPI tube, it was like a television set, and we then worked out, with dead reckoning, the vectors for the interception, the trajectory, and then our officer over the RT telephone would direct the pilots on to the interception. This was really a very, of course, planes move very fast indeed, so there was no room for error. If you made a mistake, well, probably the interception would have been aborted completely. So we had to be very quick and we had to be very accurate. I read the PPI tube usually, and at the early days I used to control the aerial. The blips would come up, which was we picked up the aircraft, they would come up on the PPI tube, they would fade very quickly. So the trick was really to control the aerial so that it swept through and we didn't lose the blips. And then, as I say, the RT, the dead reckoning would have been worked out, the our officer over the RT would give the pilot instructions, and very often when the interception actually took place, the pilots would leave their RT telephones on and give us a running commentary of the actual dogfight. Now, this, of course, was really very, very exciting, and we had quite a lot of...